Welcome, listeners, to A Writer's Life. I'm your host, Heike Bohm, the author of the novel Secrets in the Shadows. A Writer's Life is a place where I'll be in conversation with fellow writers. We'll discuss all things writing, they'll read from their latest works, and we'll explore what happens beyond the pen in A Writer's Life. It's gonna be a page-turner. I just know it. Pull up a chair and join us. I'm recording on the traditional, ancestral, and unceded territory of the Squamish Nation. Welcome, listeners, to another episode of A Writer's Life. Today, I'm delighted to be in conversation with Daniel Neal. Daniel Neal was born in New Westminster, British Columbia, and grew up in North Delta. He began writing in his teens, journaling and writing poetry. He made a decision to be a writer in 1986 and took his first creative writing course in Langley with a Live magazine editor, Roddy Lake. While working for the city of Delta, he authored the motto, Ars to Preserve by Hand and Heart, for the city's coat of arms in 1988. Daniel worked steadily at his craft. His short story, Grace, was published in the 2003 Federation of BC Writers anthology, edited by Susan Musgrave. He went on to participate in the Write Stretch program with the Federation of BC Writers, teaching free verse poetry to school children. As well, he was a participant in the Word on the Street Vancouver. He won the Poetry Prize at the Surrey International Writers Conference 4 times and went on to study creative writing at UBC. His first published novel was The Killing Jars in 2006, and then Flight of the Dragonfly in 2009. My June in 2014, and The Trees of Callan Gray in 2015. Dominion of Mercy is his 5th published novel. He has completed 20 novels since beginning his writing journey. His prose has been called hauntingly beautiful and lyrical. His poetry and fiction articulate a close relationship with the land, its felt presence in his narrative and vision. His characters arrive like guests and leave an edible presence in a reader's experience. Daniel lives in Oliver, the South Okanagan of British Columbia. Welcome, Daniel, to A Writer's Life.
Well, thank you, Maga. Pleased to be here.
What was it like around your dinner table when you were growing up?
Well, that's an interesting question. You know, it could go both ways, but I'll give you this, that in that generation at the dinner table, we were all, my 2 brothers and a sister and a mother. My dad kind of carried things, you know, he was a storyteller. He carried what happened to him that day. This is in the 60s, mind you. And so, you know, we all listened. We came from a generation of being seen but not heard. So mostly it was how his day went, and he would go into great detail. So I learned a lot about that. It's interesting that sometimes dinner tables today are more democratic. Back then, they weren't so much. You absorb a lot from what he says. You pay attention, and it registers at some level. But it was a consistent daily experience that perhaps not so much today, but the dinner time when I grew up, that was when everybody came together, but perhaps we didn't get to share it like we would today. But I learned so much from him, how his day went. It was a really good memory.
In your bio, you say you began writing in your teens. What sparked that interest? And did you always know you wanted to be a writer?
You know, I did. In grade 2, there was I think Mrs. Nixon. She wanted all of us to write a story. My story about Tarzan, she read it out to the class. Now, after that, I didn't really get an opportunity to really in grade 10 when you start journaling and that type of thing. I started writing poetry. I still got my Duotang from English 12. And my first writing, and back then it was kind of grandiose writing. It was, you know, reaching for words and things like that. But it was a start. I grew up on Canadiana. My dad used to read us books like Grass Beyond the Mountain, Rancher Takes a Wife, and stuff like that. British Columbia classics, Three Gates of Wilderness, and we would sit around me and read his books. Like, it got me really interested. So when I started writing as a teenager, it was mostly about the environment, mostly about the outdoors. And I took a great interest in nature. It all kind of morphed into wanting to be a writer. But I had a family, and that sort of puts a stop on it for a while. So in 1986, when I worked for the Corporation of Delta, and it was I was looking after a lot of large development projects. So I didn't want to do that. I wanted to be a writer. So I decided, how am I going to do that? So I decided to write a story about my dad growing up in Headley. He grew up in Headley, the mining town of Headley, Oregon, Christmas Day, 1926. You know, it was an incredible story. So I decided to do that and interviewed his friends. And I just started. I'm going to be a writer. So I began. I hadn't stopped. You know, I'm on my 22nd novel. I just keep writing. I learned that if you quit, it's not going to happen. And I didn't want that regret. I just had this big dream. You know, I was just going through the other day that my rejection letters, I had a whole bunch of them, the 90s. A pretty big rejection or some interesting, helpful comments. The first book, Bull Town Boys, was sent to CBC Drama Department. I got a letter from Hart Hansen, who's the executive producer of Bones in Los Angeles. He was an intern CBC, a drama correspondent in 1989. So I got this letter from Hart, and I told him on Twitter that thank you very much. It kind of started things for me. But one thing about that is that after that was finished and I sent it out, I thought it was going to be published that weekend. So you really, but you have to have a certain naivete. You have to have a certain larger image of yourself and confidence, or you wouldn't write. So I had this confidence, but over time, that kind of straightens you out. You realize that you have to put the work in. You put the work in, and that's what I did. And you know, I'm still putting the work in, still learning.
It's so true, because when I wrote my novel, I thought for sure the first person I send it out to, they're going to publish it. I'm going to make millions on it, and I'm going to sell movie rights, and Martin Scorsese is going to make my movie. No ands, ifs, or buts. And that was it. And yeah. It's true. You do have to have a sense of grandiosis. You really do, in order to keep writing. Otherwise, you wouldn't do it.
Yeah, if you don't aim high, you're always falling short. So I would reach way too high. But yeah, things didn't start to materialize until early 2000s, where my writing came together and I started winning contests and the Surrey International Writers Conference. And so it started to materialize and I found my voice finally. What I did was I spent a lot of time looking at how other writers handled their work. And I started with Margaret Lawrence and Stone Angel, and that kind of informed me what fiction really is. After that, it was Cormac McCarthy, Larry McMurtry. And finally, my favorite book, The Shipping News with Annie Proulx. I mean, I read that over and over as the Bible of fiction. I just love that book. So overall, you find your voice, and you know, you get a mixture of influences. Most people do, most writers do, but you kind of find your own way of expressing with all those influences, so it ends up being your voice, and that's where I am now.
It is, there is something to be said about trying to find your own voice, what that is. And I know for me, when I was writing my novel, I thought, oh, maybe if I write like somebody else, then be published. So I'll try to do it. And so I was writing this one scene and I go on about how beautiful the black crows are. And it's all this poetic stuff. And I thought, I'm an incredible genius. This is beautiful. So I thought, okay, just leave it for a day, check it tomorrow. The next day I go and look at it and I go, what the hell is this? This is absolutely horrible. You can't write this. And then that's when I realized, no, no, just try to figure out who you are and what your voice is. It was a good reminder. Don't copy other people.
It is true. You know, Ron Hatch, who's a brilliant editor, once told me in one of my submissions, too much McCarthy, Dan. Too much McCormack McCarthy in there. I was probably trying a little bit too hard to emulate one of my heroes. And he always brought me back to reality. And I was like, always grateful for that.
I did that with Betty Keller was my mentor. She still is. Yeah. And she had taken me one-on-one and I really admire her and I wanted to impress her. And so I go to her and I give her my 10 pages and she goes, what's with all these big words? And I said, well, I'm trying to sound smart. And she goes, well, just stop it.
Yes, that's right. You learn simple is better. And you have to reach for words that are, that suit the narrative, I guess. And that takes a lot of practice.
Yeah.
That's the craft too.
Yeah, I love all those moments, though. They're very humbling, and they set you on the right path.
I've been humbled many times, yeah.
Oh, that's wonderful. You have published 5 books, but have completed 21 novels. That's a lot of writing. What does a typical writing day look like for you?
First, I need a place. Like, I don't like to write at home because it's pretty isolating. Writing, I find, is isolating. I wrote most of my novels in coffee shops and Starbucks or chapters and that type of thing. I would write there. So, and I can only write for a couple hours a day. I never have writer's block. It just flows, from me. I sit down and the first thing comes in my head. It's usually that's it. My work has little editing in it. What I always told my last novel, had a little arrogant edit. It took me 6-7 months to write that.
Wow.
But I can only write about 2 hours a day because it's pretty intense. It's almost like I'm channeling the character, the protagonist. And so then I drop it. I do my research, prepare my notes, research as I go. Then the next time I sit down, the next day, I'll just ask myself, what should happen now? And if I ask myself what should happen now, it comes. And it comes from the universe. It comes from the creativity of the universe. I'm not too sure where it comes from, but it works for me. I start novels that I, after 3 chapters, well, this is not going, I'll drop it and I'll start another one. And if I'm connect with the protagonist in the boat, 2 chapters, you know, I got something. The one on Dominion of Mercy was I the first page, I connected with my character right away. And most people will read it the same thing. They connect there. And that's the thing about writing. You have to get your audience to identify with that character right away. And that takes a long time. Sometimes you don't know what you're doing. But mostly in the day, it's about 2 or 3 hours. And I forget about it because I don't know about you, Hagen, but when you're out and about and you start thinking about your novel and you come up with a really great line and you go back home and you can't remember it. So I call that story leak. So I don't do that unless I have pen and pencil or a paper and pencil. Then you're writing it out. So I just stop it. When I write, I write. When I'm not, and I grab my camera and I go out to balance my day. So I consistently every day, I don't write all day. No, just a few hours.
Nice, nice. I tend to binge write. I write whenever I possibly can.
Awesome.
And my characters are always talking to me in my head. I have several books in my head and all those characters keep coming out. And the way I silence them is in my mind, I put them to sleep. It's like, okay, it's time for you to go to bed now. I have to go on with my day. And that's what I do to keep them quiet.
Oh, that's good. It is funny. It's characters are... They seem to arrive with something to say, and we're the boss. So, you know, they have to wait their turn.
That's great you say that we're the boss, because a lot of times I don't feel like it. I feel like they're taking over and they're like, you got to do this when we want it. And I'm fighting with them right now. I'm like, no, I just can't. I have other things to do. Just leave me alone. But they just keep knocking and it's like, it's frustrating. And so they're not even wanting to really go to bed right now either.
Right.
Yeah. So I have to remember that I'm the boss.
Yeah.
So that brings me to my next question. A lot of your books and poetry are tied to the land. Obviously, the natural world is greatly important to you. Was that always in you, or was it taught to you? Can you speak about that a bit?
I think my dad was a huge influence when he grew up in Italy. I mean, it was all hunting and fishing. And so we did that as kids. And he took us up to Italy, up in the mountains. And I just love nature. I was really born into it. So it's a huge part of my life. And when I write, I want people to have a felt experience. To me, those details about the environment kind of hold up my novels. And so I really love that. Or I go out every day with my camera. I do wildlife photography to balance, to keep myself grounded. Because if you're in your head a lot with a novel or a book, you need, you know, the land is such a grounding thing. So it's really important. I pay attention when I'm out. You know, it's easy to do when you're out because there's the wind and the heat. All those senses you to incorporate into a book, into a novel. Every page, so that it sort of drips with, to give them a bigger sense of reality, because you want a big buy-in by a reader. And to me, this is the way I do. I like to immerse part of the natural world in everything I do, just to get a sense, seen, just so people can kind of feel where they're at.
It's almost like the natural world, the weather, the climate, the land. It's, I find in my writing, it becomes a character in itself. It sounds like that's what happens for you as well.
Yes, yeah, exactly like that. You know, it's the backdrop of our existence, so it's necessary for sure.
Your latest novel, Dominion of Mercy, is out this April 15th. What sparked the idea for this novel?
Just looking at publishing in general, you probably realize this, that publishers weren't getting back to you. You wouldn't even get a response. I wouldn't get responses. I wouldn't get rejection, or they were holding on to them. So I talked to an editor in Toronto, and she said that publishers are overwhelmed with submissions. And I looked at, okay, what is needed in Canada? What is needed in literary Canada? And immigration stories are big. They're important. You know, everybody needs to understand. And women, strong voices in women. I was raised by a strong woman, my grandmother. So I wanted to write about women. I wanted to write about immigration. But there's only one immigration story that I know, and that is Scotland. Three of my grandparents came from Scotland. So that's the only one I know. Part of the story is Antioch's, the destination, B.C., it's on the Alaskan BC border. It existed from 1914 to 1935, and it burned down in 1943. When the copper prices left, everybody just left. So that was a real town. My grandfather worked there in 1916. There's nothing left there. It was an incredible place when you do the research. That was going to be the destination of my character. My character was banished from Edinburgh, a prostitute, 18-year-old prostitute of an uncle who had political aspirations, sent her as far as he waved he could to this grand city called Antioch on the in the colonies. And that's all she knew. It was a grand city. Putting those together, I had a little bit of family history. My grandmother was not a prostitute, mind you. But my grandfather worked in Antioch. So I had this, it was authentic to me. And it almost gave me license to write about the destination. And the research in Antioch is phenomenal. It was great fun. So that's what I decided to do, a powerful woman. And the thing about the society at that time in 1917, this was right around the suffragettes, and women were being I would say the subjugation of women has been around for such a long time. And I couldn't write a story from a male perspective. I had to do it from a woman. You know what I mean? Because it was so dominant. So I gave her a very strong, willful wit, cutting, and how she responds to the society. So you get such a contrast. And she's a heroine. She's powerful. She's a force of nature. She's all of those things. And that's what I try to do. This is like anything. When I send it out, you just hope you're going to hear from someone. But I found a really good publisher in the West Press, a brilliant group of academics and board members. It's just phenomenal. I'm very, very lucky. But that's what started me on that journey. And it's been a lot of fun.
Wonderful. So did you have photos of that place? Did you travel there? Did you connect and speak to people that had lived there? Or did you just go from stories that you remember your father or grandfather talking about?
Yeah, I remember my dad talking about his dad that worked there. Of course, my dad's father died in 1940. He was only 13 when he died. But when you look up Antioch, there's hundreds and hundreds of pictures, photos from even in the UBC library. And I went through them, incredible photographs. The archives in Prince Rupert and even in the provincial government archive, there's lots of information on it. And there's, so I went through that. There's a book written, one book written about it. I read that, studied maps and charts and steamships. And that is the joy, and that's the reward of writing, is what you learn in research. And basically I did that. I used to have hundreds of pictures on my table and you know, and I just created this map, this, because you only can write a lane. You can't write a history of anything. You pick your lane and you gather all the details for that lane and you tell that story. You know, you'll recognize Antioch historically. It's the plank roads. There's no roads. It's just plank roads. The smelter killed all the trees. It's massive. So nothing lived. Fires in the summertime. No animals, no pets, no vegetation, no gardens. Just plank roads everywhere. And these company houses. And there's 3,000 people living there. And there is a theater. And there was hospitals. And there was three churches. And there's a big harbor where steamships came in. And there's 600 miners worked there, 3,000 people. It was like a city on the Alaska-BC border, 100 miles from nowhere, and it existed in 1917. It was incredible, the biggest smelter in the Commonwealth at the time. And then copper prices left or died. In 1935, people walked away. The mine, the Granby consolidated, they walked away, left everybody there. They were stranded and they just walked away from their homes. And apparently even people from Vancouver went up on boats to ransack the building, the empty houses. Then they just sat there for another 20 years. And in 1943, a forest fire burned all the houses down, everything. Now there's only two smelter stacks sticking up out of the emerging wilderness. So it's a ghost town, but has an incredible history, like a lot of ghost towns in BC.
It's kind of wonderful how nature reclaimed its land.
Yes, for sure.
Did you go up there at all?
No, to get there, you would need to take a charter float plane, or you have to take an echo tour, or there's a logging roads from Stewart, BC. But it's so remote down these inlets, observatory, like 60 miles down observatory inlet, Portland, Channel. I mean, it's so hard to get to, but you can if you really wanted to, but I haven't.
How long would the journey have been from Edinburgh to go?
I try to figure it out based on how far, because I started out with the big cruise liner, the SS Missinabe, how many knots, how fast they could get to St. John in New Brunswick, then on a train, how long does it take to get from St. John to Vancouver and Cole Harbor. Then you take a steamship, the Princess May. How long does it take to get to Prince Rupert? Then Prince Rupert. It's why I had to find a way to calculate that. So I came up with 2 months, because the train was pretty, you know, the train across Canada, it was pretty efficient. I mean, that's just, it's a steady. And I think I gave it 2 months, but I'm sure reality is probably different.
Would you delight our listeners by reading an excerpt from your novel, Dominion of Mercy?
Yes, I would. And this is interesting part. What I'm going to read is, since the uncle in Edinburgh set up this grandiose, this huge city with all its amenities and a modern city, and she's going up on steamship, and she's going, it's farther and farther and farther away. It's just wilderness. British Columbia, the coast, is just such wilderness. And she meets two gentlemen, businessmen on the steamer, and asks them about Antioch. And they kind of play along with her and make it even bigger or grander. So I'll read that. She's just had her breakfast upon the steamer, and she's going to talk to these gentlemen. "Excuse me, gentlemen," I said. They both turned to me and seemed to be in good temper. "I did not intend to listen to your conversation, but I did overhear you refer to the city of Antioch." "The city of Antioch, you say?" one said rather curiously. "Yes, I would like to know how far until we reach that city." "You call it a city, miss," the other said. They both seemed surprised by my query. "Yes, I understand that Antioch has all the modern amenities of a grand city. I've been traveling for weeks, and I'm anxious to arrive at my destination. Surely you know it, but..." Oddly, they both laughed. I didn't understand. "Did I say something amusing, gentlemen?" I could feel the unloosening of my tongue, but as providence would have it, they each turned to the other and seemed to decide that they would assist me. "Prince Rupert is our destination," this one said, "and it happens to be the next port of call for this good ship. We're in the cannery business. Salmon, miss. The likes you've never seen. But we know Antioch, don't we, George?" "We'll be there in 5 hours," George said. "And yes, it's a grand city. I would say one of the most beautiful cities in the world, with its forested mountains and snow-capped peaks, and above it all the splendid blue sky. It is set in a magnificent harbor. There are wooded islands scattered all about the channel, a pristine paradise. You will want nothing in Antioch. I know there are many who live like kings. The smelter has made many a rich man. Copper is a softer gold. Isn't that so, Gordon? The ships are taking people there all the time just to see its beauty. The finished copper slabs ablaze in the sun awaiting shipment. Now that's a sight. You'll see for yourself. Whatever you've heard, it'll be that and then some." I watched their faces, stone sober. "Well, I thank you very much, gentlemen," I said. "I'm sure it'll be just as you say." When the Princess May began to pull away from Prince Rupert, I felt much better. I had a sense of relief that my journey would soon be over, that my new life was just over the horizon. I felt invigorated. I looked back at the coastal town like so many, with its docks and ships and upland houses hewn out of the forest. Wood smoke from chimneys plumed like thin cotton, and the fishing fleet was tied fast to the canneries where the two gentlemen waved their hats madly and seemed to cheer for no reason at all. It wasn't long before we entered Portland Inlet, an arm of ocean, a firth penetrating the mountains as far as I could see. The afternoon was overcast with high clouds, but warm. I joined passengers on the deck as there were killer whales about, black and swift, magnificent creatures with their tall black fins that drew gas from the onlookers. It was thrilling indeed, and then they were gone. But still so much to see. There was constant gulls abreast the ship, never gaining and never falling behind, and great birds lifting from their forest perches with their white noble crowns like aristocrats, surely eagles of the wild colony. I wondered if I could come to like British Columbia coast with its immeasurable bays and arms and massive forested upheavals, all unending, incomprehensible. It truly seemed that Portland Inlet would never end, never cease to be somewhere a city. Then the inlet gave way at last. But yet, another sea, observatory inlet. The ship plodded on in the late afternoon. Then the air began to cool. I snugged my tartan shawl under my chin. The gulls disappeared. I felt a drop of rain on my cheek, and then the several on my fingers that held fast to the railing. A sharp gust of wind, and the sky darkened. The sea churned, and the great black crowns of waves collapsed and foamed. The other passengers returned to the sanctuary of the ship as the black clouds settled low over the inlet, and it began to rain in earnest. I stayed a minute longer. I didn't know why I hesitated, but I thought I saw something. I looked off to the port side of the ship, a vague impression, a break in the landscape, a smudge of smoke, perhaps manioc at last. It was all so vague. As we got nearer, the amorphous haze began to reveal its secrets. Dark, brooding buildings of all sizes, but without form or definition. It seemed a muddy conglomerate in the rain. I tried to find the city in such obscurity, the city I had traveled so far to see. The ship signaled as we approached a sheltered harbor, then the pull and shudder of its engines. I could see other ships' tides against a wide, sweeping wharf. And then there it was, against the rising gray mountains, what had to be the machinery of production, the copperwork, the smelter itself, an enormous warehouse-like structure with a towering chimney spewing great clouds that drifted up and over what was surely a town and not a city at all. It appeared funereal and black under a low ceiling of gauzy clouds, and the air so fouled with the smell of sulfur and rotten eggs. It seemed a colorless wasteland of stumps and industry, the squat houses roll and roll like inky toadstools. My legs duly sagged beneath me, the cannery men be damned. The storm was upon us now. I felt a sudden disenchantment and such discouragement and distress that I thought I'd become physically ill. And then as I stood slackly and soaked to my skin, I spoke aloud, but the words shattered in my mouth like glass. Oh, where is my forbearance and willingness now, good uncle?
Well done.
Thank you.
What was the most difficult thing about writing the characters from the opposite sex?
None.
Really, I wrote two boy characters and I found that really, really easy. And my next book is all women and I'm finding it really challenging. So what's the secret?
Oh, interesting. I've written four other novels from the first person of a woman. So, and I think I was raised by a woman, you know, and I think I have the feminine component like most males do. Maybe it's understated. I don't know, but I felt like I channeled her. I felt comfortable in her. I could hear her in my head. I could hear her. I knew her. So it wasn't hard for me. Yeah, I could do pretty much anything I wanted. This is sort of a non-typical time, 1917. So you kind of guess what the sentiment, what the sensibility of the day was, and how people behaved. It was very, you know, just post-Victorian. So it's a lot of it is guesswork. You're creating a character, so I just make them big.
Who was your favorite character to write in this novel, and who was the hardest character to write in this novel?
Well, since the protagonist is the first person, so that was a delight. The other one is the villain. To keep a villain in the story, it creates a tension because you know it's building up to something. You just don't bring in, you can bring in a character briefly and you know that you may not see them again. But this one here was part of the fuse of the story was this villain. And I had to keep the tension without giving it away, without you being lost in this other thing that may happen. So to separate Mary's journey from the character Quinn, that was hard to keep him in the story, but not in it in a more, I would say, obvious way, because I wanted him sort of hidden. But you'd know in the back of your head that he's there somewhere. So I think that was the hardest part of writing is to keep that tension without giving away the story and without giving away the ending, because, you know, the ending in this story here is kind of the triumphant part of the story. And, you know, if you know that that is coming, well, it takes away that triumphant part. So the part of craft of writing is to develop those nuances of tension and keeping it just in the background a bit so that the reader knows when it comes, it's not a surprise. Oh yeah, you know what I mean? But it's not a story that's been told too early. You know, I had to tell the story at the end. You know, it's a long journey and you can't give it away. That's the hard one. Another hard part of challenge is to give it away way before it's time. And that's what I tried to do, I guess. I think I did.
What is the most surprising thing you discovered while writing Dominion of Mercy?
I would say how big Canada is compared to Scotland. Just the geography. I mean, when I was doing the train ride from Edinburgh to Glasgow to Liverpool, you know, it seems like it's just like a couple hundred miles. It's just shocking how I did not know. Because when you look at a map, you look at Europe, you really can't judge it. But when you start from St. John to go to Vancouver, through all the provinces, it's incredibly how, so the scale of Canada. Part of my novel is the First Nations. I always put an element of the First Nations in my work because we always must recognize that colonialism was not a good experience. It was an awful experience and still is. So to recognize that Aniamek's, the story of Aniamek took place on Nisga land, traditional land. So I always make sure that I do some research, you know, on First Nations. And I did include a few things in the book about a missionary and the impact he had on First Nations. And I also did a short piece on the afterword of the book about the Spanish flu. My idea was to go into the Spanish flu. This is before our pandemic. And I found that the Spanish flu is too big of a story on its own. So I stopped it in 1917. But I did in the afterword, the Spanish flu did come to Aniaks. And it came across Canada returning troops. And it's, and on the trains took it to every part of Canada. And the steamships took it to Aniaks. And interestingly enough, there was six deaths per thousand in BC, 46 deaths per thousands for First Nations. So there's, it had a huge impact. So those are the we're talking about research. I mean, those are the things that writing does. I mean, you just learn things that perhaps you should have known, but things you would never, ever know. That's sometimes that is the reward, the things you know.
That I think that's the wonderful thing about writing historical fiction, that it's easy for the readers to understand history.
Yeah, you really need to, when you write any kind of fiction and you're writing a place like, you know, Margaret Lawrence created a town, you know, you can take it a fiction, you create a fictional town, but if you add the historical context that is something real, it becomes the foundation, it becomes the backdrop. It makes the story more real. You know, if you spend the details about the physical environment as much realism that you can get into it, that doesn't interfere with your character. Like I wouldn't, you know, it's difficult to bring up historical characters. I wouldn't bring up historical characters of Aniaks. I mean, I wouldn't do that. So what you do is you get a fiction and you plunk it into history. That's what you're doing. And mm-hmm. So you get an idea of what the town looked like, but of course these people never walk the plank roads of Aniak. And the other thing you're talking about is the story. And what I tried to do is create feuds of tension right from the first line all the way through the whole thing. There's to put tension on it because it's what keeps people from turning the next page. They want to know what happens next. That's the what happens next, what happens next, what happens next. It's this fuse of tension through the whole book. So that's the other thing. I focus on that because it becomes, you find your voice, part of the fuse of tension. I use that in my voice just so people turn the page because I don't know about you. If I read something and I'm not interested, I put the book down. I want to know what happens next. So I purposely try to create this fuse of tension through the right from the first line to the last line.
Definitely, because it keeps you turning the page. Otherwise, you go make a sandwich and you put the book down.
Okay.
Your protagonist, why is she your favorite character?
I was wanting to know what sassy, sarcastic, witty thing she was going to say next. And it was just a delight because when I'm writing, I never know what's going to happen. I don't know who the characters are coming. They all sort of arrive, you know. I have a vague outline where I'm going, but I don't know what's going to happen in between. I just let the story write itself. And so I was always so anticipating with kind of joy that what is she going to say now without, you know, going over the top, keeping her within a certain framework. But yeah, her one-liners are great.
What advice do you have for a writer that's having a hard time putting words to paper?
The first thing you really got to do is you have to read a lot. They say that you find your voice. This is what I heard at the writer's conference, after a millionth word. Now, that was intimidating. That was so intimidating. But it took a long time for me to find my voice. And it's going to vary for everybody. But a young writer, you just have to write. If it's awful, you write. If it's tomorrow, will be a little better. It's just a process. And a lot of young writers today are starting, if you probably noticed, you know, creative writing degrees. I mean, journalism backgrounds. They're brilliant. They are brilliant. I started at English 12. You know, that was my benchmark. And so I took me along, I'm a Capricorn, so it took a long, long way. And I never hit a home run. I thought I wanted one, but I didn't hit a home run. But a beginning writer just has to write. And if they don't like it, well, just keep on with it and read and read and read with people who do get it right. And I read a lot of poetry as the vitamins for fiction. That's what I find. And just read and read and read and write. There's no other way. There's no other way to do it. You'll find your voice eventually. I mean, your commitment level, that's probably the biggest thing a writer needs, is a commitment level, a sense of not quitting, a sense that you love the process, not the outcome. It's the process where the joy is, not the outcome. The outcome is gravy. You know, that's the bonus if you have a good outcome. But it's the process. If you love the process, you just do it for the joy of writing. And it be outcome to look after itself, and do your work. You know, do your. What are other writers have? How do other writers handle the material? Pick the great writers. Pick out the Margaret Atwoods and the Michael Gondys or Carol Shields. How do they handle this? You know, I read a lot of Carol Shields. How does she handle women? You know, I mean, I loved her writing. So you know, they inform you. They inform your own craft. And there's no, to me, you know, a writer can only speak from their personal experience, because there is no one manual for all in writing. It's basically you learn your craft, you read, you write, and you never give up. It's, you know, that's what's worked for me. That's the only advice I can give, because what has worked for me is only related to myself. So that's my advice, is just do those three basic things. You read, you write, and never give up.
Nice. Daniel, you had decided quite early on in 1986, I believe, that you decided to become a writer. Was that one of the reasons that you started to think, if I don't do this, I will have regret about not doing this? Because I know for me, I had always wanted to be a writer, but I was so afraid that I wasn't allowed to or couldn't. I didn't have enough education. And I know for me, I would have had huge regrets, because it was my life passion. I always wanted to be a writer. Can you speak a little bit about that? About your own journey of possibly having regrets or not?
Wanting to be a writer was a dream. And dreams are, you know, I was kind of a grandiose dream, you know. I wanted to be walking down a beach with a notebook and just, you know, want to be that writer, you know. I just had this probably romantic, I'm a very romantic person, so I kind of had this romantic idea of what a writer is. But after a while, it became so much fun. It became my passion, and I didn't want to quit, because if you quit, it's not going to happen. Your dream's not going to happen unless you cultivate the dream by writing novel after novel and sending it out and getting rejection. You fall off the horse, you get back on the saddle. I did not want to regret when I'm older and getting there now. I didn't want to regret that, I should have kept with it. It would have happened. That one thought there, if I didn't give up, it might have happened. I didn't want that. So if you're writing and you never stop, at least you tried. if it doesn't happen, at least you try it. And just enjoy the process, enjoy the journey as a writer, because even though you can't tell if your writing is improving, it does. It does just get better. It's like driving golf balls. You know, the more you go to the driving range, the better you are as a golfer. So it's like that. The more you write, the better you're going to be. Maybe I started at English 12, and it took me a long time. But I'm not saying I arrived, but I'm at a good place.
You have done 21 novels, and 5 of those have been published. That's huge. I mean, what a huge body of work you've created.
You know, interesting, Trees of Cain and Gray came out in 2015. I've written 8 novels since then.
Wow. Oh, yeah. And so are you hoping to get all those published?
Well, you know, I always wanted that, of course, that maybe a publisher would be interested, or maybe would support or help those other ones that didn't, you know, that the sales weren't great. Maybe it would help them. I don't know. Yeah, I hope that would happen. But, you know, I have to write. So it's my purpose, because I've been retired since 2008.
Nice.
I'm not working in the garage. I'm not handy that way. I don't have hobbies. You know, writing is what I do. You know, I need a sense of purpose. I need a sense of fulfillment. Those two things, fulfillment and reward, writing gives me.
I always think, I go, gee, if I did continue writing, at least I did do one novel, and that's out there in the world. And I don't get to know how it affects somebody. How does it change somebody's life? And just knowing that, oh, it helped me deal with certain issues, it helped my family, my sisters and my mom, that's enough of a reward. That's a wonderful thing to sort of hold on to and to keep at the craft.
Yes. Yeah. Writing has one component that a lot of other careers don't have. There's no age limit. As long as you're mentally capable, right? It's like actors, really. That's what we're doing. You're assembling a bunch of actors together in written word as opposed to a movie. But, you know, like Christopher Plummer, I mean, you can keep on doing your craft as long as you're able. You know, careers, you know, in the conventional career, it's usually 65 and you got to do something else. Well, I wanted to be a writer since 1987, so I don't see no retirement. You know, I just keep on going until I can't write anymore.
Lovely. Daniel, thank you so much for talking with me and sharing part of your life. It was a delight and I learned so much, and I can't wait to pick up your books. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Haga. I had a great time. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome. For more information on Daniel Neal and where to purchase his book, Dominion of Mercy, take a look at the links below. And while you're at it, why not subscribe to A Writer's Life? And if you want more information about myself and my novel, Secrets in the Shadows, visit my website at www.haigabohm.ca. For a kinder world, take care of each other.